Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
You know, I guess I think I've always been a professional critic, you know, or some sort of professional appreciator or something.
Now, this is serious business here, man. Putting on a great show is the most important thing you can do. One great rock show can change the world.
Few American artists have impacted our culture more than Bob Dylan. Now, as the singer-songwriter turns 75, we go back to the beginning. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. We'll look back at Dylan's rise from an unknown folkie to a rock and roll icon. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
This is Sound Opinions, Jim, and we're going to be devoting most of this show to Bob Dylan on the occasion of his 75th birthday. And you and I have had numerous encounters with Bob, at least on stage. And it's always funny to hear stories that musicians have about Dylan playing with Dylan on stage. One of his bass players once told me that Dylan would famously go on stage without a real idea. Just say, just follow me. You know, no set list. You follow me. I'll set you off with the right chord. And as soon as the song would begin, he would turn his back on the band so nobody in the band knew exactly what Bob was playing, what chord he was playing, just to throw them off. You know, talk about a sense of humor, right?
A perverse sense of humor. We'll be getting into that and much, much more about Bob Dylan in a minute. But first, we have some music news.
All I ask is
that is the artist who has just signed what is reportedly the biggest record deal in music history, Jim. Adele has just signed with Sony Music. Apparently, her future records are going to be put out on a subsidiary of Sony, Columbia Records. This on the back of two huge best-selling records, 21 released in 2011, which sold 30 million copies, and 25, which came out last year, sold 19 million copies for the independent XL label. Now she's moved on to the majors. We're going to see if that deal is going to be able to pay off.
You know, the fascinating part about this, Greg, is that there was once upon a time in the music industry an era of so-called mega deals.
Right.
You know, from the mid-90s to the early 2000s, when you saw superstar bands like R.E.M., Aerosmith, Madonna, Prince, U2 re-up with the major label after making buku bucks the first eight albums, right? Those deals were considered unprecedented at the time. And now Adele's deal is bigger than any of those, but at a time when records are not selling. As we've said before, when talking about Adele's extraordinary success, she's one of the only artists actually moving physical units in old style numbers. It will be interesting to see if Columbia Sony's faith in her pays off.
Come here, ladies and you gentlemen, and listen to my song. I'll sing it to you right, but you might think it's wrong. Just a little glimpse of a story I'll tell about an East Coast city that y'all know well. It's hard times in the city, living down in New York town. Old New York City is a friendly old town. From Washington Heights to Harlem on down, there's a mighty many people milling all around. They'll kick you when you're up and knock you when you're down. It's hard times in the city, living down in New York town.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and that voice you're hearing is unmistakable. Of course, that's Bob Dylan. He just turned 75 years old, but on that recording, he's only 20 years old. And to honor this milestone, we're going to revisit our series celebrating this American treasure. Today's part one, the early years of Bob Dylan. Dylan the folky, Dylan the protest singer, all leading up to the day he plugged in and went electric. We're going to tackle that next week along with some more contemporary Dylan material.
Now, some of you may be groaning. I know, I can see you right through the radio saying, I don't want to hear about Bob Dylan. Guy can't sing, he's boring, it's old stuff, all right? I got to confess, I had a hard time learning to love Bob Dylan. I was born the year he put out two records, Another Side of and The Times They Are A-Changin'. It was a daunting catalog. You look up Bob Dylan on allmusic.com or Wikipedia, okay? And there's what, 50, 60 records, Greg? Where do I start? Why should I care? We are trying to take the approach of why you can stop worrying and learn to love Bob Dylan. We're not sacred about the guy. I will say he is an American treasure. He is one of the greatest talents this country has ever produced, certainly in the last century. Yet, he also has a lot of junk in his catalog. There are times when he made missteps. What is worth valuing? Where do we even start? That's going to be our goal, plus hearing some great music and hopefully turning you on to it.
We're going to take a look at Dylan in this first episode of this kid. And he was a kid, coming from Minnesota, arriving in New York City at the age of 19 in the winter of 1961. And in 3 short years, basically running that town.
I've been to Hibbing, Minnesota, and I can't imagine two places on earth that are less like each other than New York City, Greenwich Village, and Hibbing, Minnesota.
Indeed. So he comes to town with this boatload of influences, trying to fashion himself into a singer-songwriter. How does he do it in 3 short years? A lot of people, when they think about this era, they think about the protest songs, okay? It is the spokesman of a generation. It is the ultimate protest singer.
It's blowing in the wind.
Yeah, it's blowing in the wind. The times they are a-changing, Masters of War, etc. Yes, that's part of the equation here, but there's also this transition into the next phase of his career where more surreal aspects starts to come into his songwriting. I mean, think about how quickly things moved for him. Within months of coming to New York, he was being signed to one of the biggest labels in the world, Columbia Records, by no less than John Hammond, the guy who discovered Billie Holiday, Benny Goodman, Count Basie, Aretha Franklin, Pete Seeger. If not discovered them, certainly signed them to major record deals. Now he's signing Bob Dylan to Columbia Records. A few months after that, Dylan is forging a partnership with Albert Grossman, then becoming one of the most powerful managers in the record business. He had already started working with Peter, Paul, and Mary, who would basically put folk music on the mainstream map, and then made a series of albums, his self-titled release in 62, the Freewheeling record in 63, The Times They Are A-Changin' in 64, and Another Side of Dylan that same year, showing massive transitions in each one of those records in his approach as a performer and as a singer-songwriter.
Later on, Greg, we're going to play our favorite Dylan tracks from that early period. But first, we've got a conversation with music writer Clinton Halen. We spoke to him back in 2009. He's written a number of fine books about Dylan, including Behind the Shades and most recently, Still on the Road. Clinton took us through the history of this period and most importantly, through the songs. First, we wanted to know, where was Dylan musically when he arrived in New York City from Hibbing, Minnesota and Dinky Town in Minneapolis at the young age of 19?
Well, when he arrived in New York in January 1961, I guess the most important thing to say is that he was not a songwriter. He adapted a couple of old spirituals when he was in Minneapolis, but basically he'd never written a song. And he didn't think of himself in those terms. He thought of himself as a folk troubadour in the mould of Woody Guthrie, who was, of course, his great idol at that point. One could genuinely say that New York became his muse. Literally within a month of coming to New York, he'd wrote what is probably his defining early song, Song to Woody.
Hey, Woody Guthrie, but I know that you know all the things that I'm a-saying and many times more. I'm a-singing you yeah, this song, but I can't sing enough, 'cause there's not many men who've done the things that you've done. Here's to Cisco and Sonny and Leadbelly too, and to all the good people that traveled with you. Here's to the hearts and the hands of the men that come with the dust and are gone with the wind.
He, of course, nicked the tune from Woody from 1913 Massacre. But the song, you know, Here's to Sonny and Cisco and Leadbelly 2, he's basically saying, I'm taking on the mantle.
What about his background? He obviously had been listening to a lot of this music already. He was familiar with it. And he brought it to New York. He came to New York primarily because of the folk scene. I mean, that's what all the history books keep telling us. What's your take on it?
Well, of course, he would say that he came to New York to meet Woody, which, of course, he did. What he perhaps didn't realize was that he'd arrived at a very propitious time, because Cisco Houston, who was on his last legs, quite literally, was passing through town. Pete Seeger was there. Rambling Jack Elliott turned up shortly after Dylan arrived. So all these figures that he'd only ever been able to reference on record were there in the flesh.
Clinton, other than Woody Guthrie, who was a big influence on Dylan, one that he's been very vocal about, what else was influencing him?
Kerouac, On the Road.
Right.
An obvious enough influence, but in a sense, it's something he never really talked about at the time. He himself on Theme Hour Radio obviously has played an enormous amount of material from the 50s that clearly he grew up with, I mean, particularly country music. The big influence that everyone kind of, again, minimizes, I would suggest as big an influence as Guthrie, is Leadbelly.
There is a house.
He discovers Leadbelly in the last couple of months in Hibbing, you know, in his hometown, and it just turns him around.
What is it about Leadbelly specifically that is exciting him?
Well, I mean, the one thing that he seems to have tuned into intuitively, he couldn't have known it intellectually, is what he's called the only true valid death you can feel today, which is traditional song. That Leadbelly was, if you like, that kind of last link in the chain. He's the last guy that really is genuinely writing in what might be called a traditional style, using traditional commonplaces and creating something new out of them. And somehow Dylan tapped it and realized that this was something he'd never heard before. He didn't really understand entirely what it was, but he knew that he'd never heard anything like it.
There is a house down in New Orleans. They call the rising sun. And it's been the ruin of many poor girls and me. Oh, God, I'm a one. My mother was a tailor. She sold these new blue jeans. My sweetheart was a gambler, Lord, down in New Orleans.
Obviously, he stood out, though, pretty quickly. Dylan, out of all this group of folkies that were practicing their art in New York, Greenwich Village at the time, Dylan rose to the top very quickly. What was it about him that stood out from all of these other guys?
In the first year that he's in New York, I would have to suggest really ambition. In terms of whether he was set apart from the crowd, I don't think he really was in terms of, you know, creatively. I don't think he'd found it at that point. But what he did have was this really gut-wrenching way of getting things across.
Well, I'm gonna get you a Sally girl, I'm gonna get you a Sally girl, I'm gonna get you a Sally girl, I'm gonna get you a Sally girl. I'm just one of them rambling men, rambling since I don't know when. Here I come and I'm gone again. Sally says I got no end. I'm gonna get you a Sally girl. I'm gonna get you a Sally girl. I'm gonna get you a Sally girl. I'm gonna get you a Sally girl.
And also, he was a consummate harmonica player by that point. People underestimate that. And his ability to play bottleneck blues guitar. So things that actually he did not subsequently really become considered an intrinsic part of why Dylan is such a great figure were very important in those early days.
Mm-hmm.
He writes Blowin' in the Wind sometime in April 1962. So he's been in New York about 15 months at that point, and obviously that's a huge breakthrough.
Here's a song that's in sort of a set pattern of songs. Let's say... Say a little more than I love you and you love me, and let's go over to the banks of Italy and we'll raise a happy family. You for me and me for me.
Apart from anything else, the first person that seems to have realized just how important this song was this guy Albert Grossman, who was hovering around on the scene looking for somebody to manage. So writing that song, the thing that it really gave Dylan was a guy who actually could turn him into a star.
What was so extraordinary? What is so special? Why does that song hold up as art?
Well, I'm not sure it does. By which I mean, you know, from a personal point of view, it's not a song I've ever particularly rated.
How many times must the cannonballs fly before they forever bang?
Blowin' in the Wind just got him noticed in New York, and it kind of expressed a feeling that was presumably in the air. But it still smacks of somebody young and naive. To me, the breakthrough, the point at which he absolutely transcends everybody, comes 6 months later when he writes Hard Rain's Are Gonna Fall.
Yeah, yeah.
And nobody was writing stuff like that.
Hard rain's gonna fall means something's gonna happen. And where have you been, my darling young one? I stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of 12 dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard.
We will continue to look back at the career of Bob Dylan during his early years and invite the great Al Cooper into the conversation when we return on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. And how do you shock an audience grooving on Peter, Paul, and Mary? You plug in.
I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it.
saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you hear, my blue-eyed son?
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. We're talking about the early career of Bob Dylan. He turned 75 this month. And we're joined by music writer Clinton Halen. Now, Clinton, it's fair to say that during the first few years of Dylan's career in New York in the early 60s, he experienced a few growing pains. I mean, all of these labels were being pinned on him. A folky, the voice of a generation, the guy behind the times they are a-changing, and who killed Davy Moore. And, you know, talking to Dylan in later years, you get the sense he wasn't totally committed to those labels or that line of songwriting. So within a few years, you see him filtering some of those songs out of his set list. What's your read of that infamous protest era of Dylan's career?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a very short period in his life. I mean, effectively, we're talking about half a dozen songs. And you can pretty much follow the line, a pretty straight line, in terms of the quality of those songs, from Death of Emmett Till through to Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, which is kind of the last protest song he wrote, or at least certainly the last protest song that he wrote in the 60s. And he very quickly realizes the limitations of the form.
Hattie Carroll was a maid of the kitchen. She was 51 years old and gave birth to 10 children who carried the dishes and hauled out the garbage and never sat once at the head of the table and didn't even talk to the people at the table who just cleaned up all the food from the table and emptied the ashtrays on a whole other level.
I think that the point you were making about the protest music underscores something. Much as Kurt Cobain would revile from the title grunge. Early on, Dylan, now 21, don't hang a label on me, man. I'm not going to be part of any genre. You know, he wrote it to a certain point. It got him some notoriety. And then the minute protest singer is linked to his name and all the headlines, he's going to do something else. You mentioned Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. It seems to me that Masters of War and Hard Rain's Gonna Fall are the beginning of a move toward a more abstract kind of songwriting.
That's certainly true. I mean, the songs that he was writing in the immediate aftermath of Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, which tended to be songs that were directly linked to English folk tradition, songs like Bob Dylan's Dream, wonderful song, but an evocation of a lost childhood. I mean, that's as far from protest as you can get. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is definitely starting to feel his way around.
While riding on a train gone west, I fell asleep or to take my rest. I dreamed a dream that made me sad, concerning myself and the first few friends I've had.
And in a sense, because Freewheeling, which, you know, his second album comes out in May 63, the problem in a sense is that he's moving so fast that all these songs that he's been working on that are only 9 months old, he's already way past them. And that's part of the reason why he completely reconfigures the album at the last minute, because he realizes there's all these songs on there that he can no longer relate to. And in a sense, that is a motif for his entire career.
It wasn't well received necessarily by all the folkies who embraced him at the start either. How do you see Dylan's reacting to this? Was this fueling his, okay, you think that was radical? Listen to this. Was he affected by it in some way?
Well, I mean, the Newport 64 performance, not the fabled 65 going electric, but the Newport 64, I have said, is a far more radical performance than 65, because the movement between his 63... a performance, you know, where he is the prince of protest and he becomes the darling of Newport. And the following year, he walks on stage, plays none of those songs, but instead plays To Ramona, Chimes of Freedom, Mr. Tambourine Man, and My Back Pages.
He was born in Duluth, but his family lived up in a little mining town. As he said, he ran away from home 17 times and got brought back 16. At any rate, I don't think anybody needs to talk for him if Bob Dylan is within hearing distance. I hope he comes forward. There is he. Bob, you are sitting back there.
This is called Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man. Please play a song for me.
That is a staggering movement in a year. I mean, as I say, much more radical than the movement from Tambourine Man to Maggie's Farm, which is the one between 64 and 65.
Mm-hmm.
So he plugged in, so what?
What accounts for that transformation in your mind to go from a blatant song like The Times They Are a-Changin' in 63, Come Congressmen, Senators, Please Heed the Call, to Mr. Tambourine Man, which is just totally surreal?
Well, partly, he actually starts being honest to himself. He himself has described Times as a bullshit song, and it is. I tell the story in Behind the Shades about Tony Glover seeing the lyrics to Times Are Changing in Dylan's typewriter and saying, what the hell is this? And Dylan says it seems to be what people want. You know, I mean, that's telling. And he realizes, possibly directly affected by Kennedy's assassination, but he realizes anyway that this stuff is over. To stop living in the past. There is a period of time, and it's about 3 months, which is a long time at that point in time for Dylan. He stops writing. He stops writing songs, anyway. He starts doodling with poems and plays and stuff, but essentially he's just shutting down. And when he reemerges in February 64, it's like the chrysalis. The skin has been shed. And within 2-3 weeks, he writes Chimes of Freedom, almost immediately followed by Tambourine Man.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you.
Now, the psychedelic rock histories, Clinton, tend to say Dylan started turning on. To what extent is the influence of the drug culture kind of playing into where he's going?
Tambourine Man is written before he takes acid. So explaining it in those terms is a very poor substitute for actually doing one's homework. the truth of the matter is, just as Paul McCartney wrote all those amazing songs on Sgt. Pepper before he ever took acid, Dylan wrote Chimes of Freedom and Tambourine Man before he ever took acid. So I don't think that can be disputed.
When you talk about him reducing to rubble traditional song structure in a song like Mr. Tambourine Man, we're talking about, okay, Tin Pan Alley is way over. What's he moving into? And was it because of the poetry and the outside work that he was doing that something like Mr. Tambourine Man came along?
Well, the heaviest influence on Mr. Tambourine Man is Rambo. The Magic Swirling Ship is a direct reference to Le Bateau Ivre, which is the drunken boat, mm-hmm. Possibly Rambo's most famous poem. He clearly had started to go beyond his folk sources. He'd started to read prodigiously, and one shouldn't discount the influence of his girlfriend at the time, Susie Rotolo, who was a very articulate, well-read, and artistic lady.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and we've been talking about Bob Dylan in the first part of his career with writer Clinton Halen. In the early 60s, Dylan released four albums, and all but his first sold very well at the time. But you could argue that he was even better known as a songwriter because of the very famous cover versions of his songs, with people like Johnny Cash, The Byrds, Peter, Paul, and Mary, all covering his songs and bringing them to a wider audience. Clinton, do you have a sense of how Dylan responded to these different interpretations?
There were specific people within the Grossman camp that were being fed these songs. I mean, he would be, I'm sure if you asked him, he would be much more on the side of Odetta or Ian and Sylvia than he would be in the Peter, Paul and Mary camp in terms of who he thought was interpreting his material best.
When the rooster crows, let the breaker dawn. Look out your window, oh baby, I'll be gone. You're the reason I travel and on. But don't think twice, it's all right.
A lot of those songs are being given to people directly. You know, I mean, Judy Collins, who did an early version of I'll Keep It With Mine, heard it from Dylan. Nico claims that that song was actually written for her, and it appears to be true. Again, you know, he wrote the song, and unbelievably, considering it's one of his greatest ever songs, he gave it away.
You'd search me at any cost, but how long, babe, can you search for what's not lost? Everybody will help you. Some people are very kind, but if I can save you any time, come on.
There is that sense of him being a songwriter for hire, and of course it runs right up to the Basement Tapes, one of his three or four greatest ever achievements, and it's a bunch of demos he wrote for other people.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking about Bob Dylan with writer Clinton Halen. He has written several books on Dylan, including Revolution in the Air, interpreting Dylan's songs. Clinton, thanks for joining us on Sound Opinions.
Yeah, no problem. Delightful.
Well, hey.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and in this first installment on Bob Dylan, we've been focusing on his earliest New York years, and now Greg and I are each going to play a track that we think really stands as the best or one of the best of this era. Greg, I'm going to go with a fairly popular song, and we spent some time talking with Clinton about how a lot of the protest stuff doesn't hold up. You made the point that Dylan began phasing this stuff out of his set. There is one song, however, that I think is the very best of any of his protest anthems, and he's never phased it out. It's come up at particular times. I struggled, as I said, to learn to love Dylan, and I got into Dylan through the covers often.
I remember 1983 being at Maxwell's in Hoboken, New Jersey, on the eve of President Reagan invading a tiny island nation I didn't know existed named Grenada. And the Long Riders, a wonderful pioneering alternative country band, are on stage, and they react to this by playing Masters of War. I remember later on an invasion of a country named Iraq, the first time, seeing a band called Yola Tango, also from Hoboken, within the first, 72 hours of that invasion, and hearing Yola Tango cover Masters of War. And then you and I were reviewing Dylan not long after the beginning of the second invasion of Iraq, the second Gulf War, and Dylan comes out and plays Masters of War. This is a timeless tune. It is not, per se, an anti-war song. Dylan has said this is a pacifist anthem. That's why I think it stands the test of time, and sad to say, it always is timely. Dylan has said he was inspired by Eisenhower's famous speech upon leaving the presidency. Eisenhower telling America, beware the military-industrial complex, beware the big business of making the machines of warfare, because people who make these machines want to use them. Dylan wrote this song based on a traditional English folk song called Not a Mun Town. That's basically a nonsense song, a lot of surreal imagery based on the mummers' plays in England. It migrates over to the United States and is a popular folk song in the Appalachian Mountains. Dylan borrows a specific arrangement of it by a folk singer named Gene Ritchie, who he eventually has to pay $5,000 to for stealing that arrangement, and he's on fire. Rare, even among the early protest songs, is the use of you and I. Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, I can see through your masks. He's angry. I think this is an incredible song. It gives me goosebumps talking about it. Even better is going to be when you hear it. Try to listen to it with fresh ears. Bob Dylan, Masters of War, from the Free Will and Dylan in 1963.
He's thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. Before threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young, you might say I'm unlearned, but there's one thing I know, I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find, when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I'll follow your casket by the pale afternoon, and I'll watch while you're lowered down to your deathbed. And I'll stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.
That is Bob Dylan's Masters of War. Greg, have you got a Dylan track for us?
Well, that is an undeniable masterpiece, Jim, and what I'm going to play is a song that has barely even been heard in the Dylan catalog. It is nowhere near the status of Masters of War, but I think it illustrates perfectly what an outstanding singer and performer Bob Dylan was when he came to New York. Yes, I said a great singer. You know, when I think about rock and roll, my definition of that is amplified personality. And I think Bob Dylan defined that amplified personality when he came to New York. He says, this is my voice. I am going to let it out into the world. I don't care what you think of it, but this is me. This is who I am.
Yeah.
And he's drawing on these influences that were pretty deep at the time. He was coming at it from the sound of those old mountain soul singers that he heard on that Harry Smith folk anthology. This is a traditional southern mountain ballad, Moonshiner, that he was interpreting. And I want you to listen to a few things here. One, the subtle guitar playing, that undulating finger-picked guitar that he was playing underneath it. The harmonica playing. And finally, the voice. You keep hearing the chroniclers of our American folk and country traditions talking about that high, lonesome sound. I think that's what Dylan had in his voice when he sings this song. And what attracted him to it? It's three very succinct verses. In the first one, the guy's talking about his life. The product he makes to live is killing him. In the second verse, he's talking about the fact that this booze, this stuff that he's addicted to, is more important to him than a woman. It consigns him to a life of complete loneliness. And in the final verse, he gets really existential about it. He's basically saying, my life ain't worth a damn. Once this bottle empties, it's over. It's pretty heavy-duty stuff. You can see why Dylan was attracted to this song. And that kind of songwriting has influenced his entire career. Here it is, Moonshiner, by Bob Dylan on Sound Opinions.
I go to some bar room and drink with my friends, where the women can't follow and see what I spend. God bless them pretty women, I wish they was mine. Their breath is as sweet as the dew on the vine. Let me eat when I'm hungry. Let me drink when I'm dry. Dollars when I'm hard up. Religion. It sure ain't worth a damn.
That's Moonshiner from a 22-year-old Bob Dylan as part of our discussion of a 75-year-old Bob Dylan. And of course, we want to hear from you. What are your thoughts about Dylan's early career? His stint as a protest singer, a folky, the village years, and that high, lonesome voice. Call us at 888-859-1800. When we come back, we're joined by a man with no shortage of opinions, singer, songwriter, and organ player Al Cooper. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
If today was not a crooked highway, if tonight I could finally stand tall, if tomorrow wasn't such a long time, then lonesome would mean nothing to me at all.
Isn't only if my own true love was waiting. Isn't if I could hear her heart softly pounding. Only if she was lying by me. And I'd lie in my bed once again.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm-reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, batch out laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway looking for a new friend. The man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. We're continuing our look back at 75 years of Bob Dylan. Our goal is to listen to the music with fresh ears. Today, we're going back to the music just before Dylan plugs in and goes electric.
Yeah, Jim, it was an extraordinary period of time between March 1965 and June of 1966. It's pretty hard to imagine any other rock performer of the last half century having a better 15 months
for
than
sure.
Bob Dylan had. He completely changed the game. You know, everybody says he went electric. Well, what does that mean, really? I think there was a number of things happening for Dylan here. First of all, he was broadening his reach as a songwriter. We saw that near the end of the folk period with songs like Mr. Tambourine Man, where he was going for a more poetic, symbolic imagery in his songs. But also as a musician, here's a guy who always had his antenna up, and he was paying close attention to what was going on in England at the time. I mean, the Beatles blew his mind. He didn't see them as a bubblegum pop group the way some of the hardcore folkies did. He saw them as the next wave. This was not a snap judgment on his part. I mean, he had rock and roll in his DNA. He was a huge Little Richard fan growing up in northern Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
He saw some of these people play, and now he was ready to embrace the next wave. He was ready to incorporate that symbolic, poetic imagery of his songs and wed it with rock and roll. And so it produced this extraordinary run of albums, bringing it all back home in 1965, which was half electric and mm-hmm. half acoustic. Later on that year, Highway 61 Revisited, an all-electric album, and then the capstone, the double album, Blonde on Blonde, in June of 66.
Greg, as you said, rock and roll was always part of Dylan's makeup. Now it was coming to the fore, and one of the men by his side in helping him realize this was Al Cooper, Brooklyn-born legend. You talk about a Zelig in the rock world. You know, Al starts out as a songwriter, writes This Diamond Ring, goes on to form Blood, Sweat, and Tears, but leaves before they become really popular. In between, he'd been a huge part of the blues revival in America, eventually winds up as an A&R man with a record label in the South that discovers Lynyrd Skynyrd. You know, you name it. We could tell Al Cooper stories endlessly, but we wanted to turn to him because he bridges that period where Dylan is a fixture in the Greenwich Village folk scene, and then he plugs in, and Al is with him on stage and in the studio throughout that period.
Yeah, Jim, and he was there with him during one of the most famous or infamous rock concerts in history, the day that Dylan changed rock and roll in a lot of ways, July 25th, 1965, the Newport Folk Festival in Rhode Island. That festival was founded, remember, by Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman, and Dylan had appeared there in folk mode the previous 2 years to great acclaim.
All I really wanna do is baby be friends with you.
But in 65, as a headliner, he plugged in for the first time. We spoke to Al in 2009 and started there at that infamous Newport show. A lot was written about it, and most was made of the fact that Dylan was booed. And not only that set, but for the remainder of that tour. But that wasn't how Al remembered it.
He wasn't booed.
Yeah, tell us exactly what happened.
Well, the concept of him playing electric was sort of conjured up a couple of days before the show. And I actually had bought tickets and went to the show. I used to go every year. It was like sort of a social thing. It was Facebook for the summer back in those days. So there I was, and I was walking around in the afternoon, and I bumped into Albert Grossman, who was Bob's manager at the time. And he said, Bob is looking for you. Why don't you meet us back here tonight? Here are some passes. So I hooked up with Bob, and he said that he wanted to play live, and would I play with him? He wanted to play with a band. And he was going to use Butterfield's band, but he wanted me to play with them. I said, sure, sounds like fun. And we had just finished doing the album. Maybe we were 2 weeks after we did the album, something like that.
Highway 61 Revisited.
Yeah. So, you know, it was fresh in my mind and everything. The night before, Saturday night, because we played on a Sunday, we had a rehearsal at one of those, like, millionaires' mansions in Newport. And we stayed up all night. And the Butterfield band was not the right band to do that with. And so he had a lot of trouble. I mean, Bloomfield, you know, was great. And I'm not saying that the rest of them were not great, but it wasn't, some of it wasn't the music that they played. And so we only got 3 songs rehearsed mm-hmm. that we could play. So Bob was headlining the festival, and a lot of college kids came, you know, just to see him and, like, sat through all this, what they thought was bizarre music, just to hear Dylan. The average set was between 45 minutes and an hour. And we came out, and first of all, we played electric, which was bizarre for Newport, although other people had done it. Chambers Brothers and Butterfield are two that come to mind. And then we only played for 15 minutes because we only had 3 songs rehearsed.
I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. Well, I try my best to be just like I am, but everybody wants you to be just like them. They say sing while
that's what caused the fracas. Here's the headliner of the festival, and he plays only a quarter as long as everybody else has played. People didn't like that. And as I walked off stage, I caught a conversation between Bob and Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary, who was the MC of the show that night. And he said, where are you going? What are you doing? He said, we only know three songs. He said, well, why don't you play some acoustic songs? He says, I don't have an acoustic guitar with me. He said, well, take mine. You can't just leave them like that. And he said, okay. And then he went out and played what I thought was the best part of the whole show. Was he played It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. Good choice.
Yeah.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you'd better grab it fast. Yonder stands your orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun. Look out, the saints are coming through, and it's all over now, baby blue.
It was like a really amazing moment. It was an amazing thing to see. But booing, no booing.
Yeah, they were just disappointed, and they wanted him to play longer. It was not a case of, boo, you're going electric and selling out the whole folk movement, which is the mythology going around in most of the history books.
Well, I know why that happened. It's because the press was aware of a problem between, you know, the board of governors and Albert Grossman about the fact that Dylan was playing electric. They weren't happy about it, but they didn't say he can't play. And then during Saturday afternoon, the Butterfield Band played a set in the afternoon, and they were introduced by Alan Lomax, and he made reference to the fact that they were playing electric and that was not a good thing. And so they started playing, and then just to the left of the stage, Albert Grossman and Alan Lomax had a fist fight during the Butterfield Band set, which the press saw. And so they were aware of a turbulence. And so somebody manufactured the rest of it. The Pete Seeger with the fire axe going to cut the cable, garbage.
Were you surprised the first time the blues came?
Yeah, they were. That was at Newport. Well, I did this very crazy thing. So, you know, I mean, I didn't really know what was going to happen. But they certainly booed, I'll tell you that. You could hear it all over the place. I don't know who they were, though. I mean, they must be pretty rich to be able to go someplace and boo.
We've been talking about Dylan plugging in with our guest, Al Cooper. Next week, we dive into Blonde on Blonde and bring Dylan's career into the present.
Sound Opinions was produced this week by Evan Chung, Alex Claiborne, our intern Libby Gormley, and some help from Jason Mark.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
My name is Daniel Rishi. I live in the Chicago area, and I just wanted to call you to thank you for your Sound Opinions classic album dissection of Pet Sounds a couple weeks ago. The Beach Boys were my first favorite band and the first band that I saw in concert when I saw them in 1989. I remember my friend's parents saying, "The Beach Boys, they are our band." When we asked to go to the concert, they smiled at us, but that didn't stop us. I love singing along to the harmonies of the Beach Boys, and I also love the feeling of summer that I got when I listened to the Beach Boys. Although I was a longtime Beach Boys fan, it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I discovered Pet Sounds and found that the harmonies that they had were the same harmonies that I love from the Beach Boys that I listened to growing up. But this time it had those harmonies paired up next to the feelings of love and also the feeling of loneliness.
I guess I just wasn't made for these times.
The Beach Boys passed the test of time, and they aren't just my parents' band, but they're also my band. So here's to 50 years of Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys. Thanks a lot, guys.
Hi, my name is Tessa. I've been listening to your Riot Girl episode, and I have to say that the impact that that music has had on me as a musician is that I go out and I make music, and I can walk away from any stage or any audience satisfied that the music I'm making is worthwhile and means something, regardless of however they feel about it. I kind of listen to this music as though it's just helped me find my voice in so many ways.
Hi, guys. This is Andy from Austin, Texas. I love the show on Riot Girl this past week. As a young queer and feminist punker in my day, I can say Riot Girl was indispensable to so many young punks. You mentioned queercore, also known as homocore, as an ancillary movement. I wanted to correct you on that subtle but important point. Homocore bands like Team Dresch, God Is My Co-Pilot, Tribe 8, came out of a vibrant underground zine movement that also largely sparked Riot Girl. In fact, the original spark was the zine Juvenile Delinquents by Toronto queer artists Bruce LaBruce and G.B. Jones of the queer post-punk band and art collective Fifth Column. J.D.'s was the zine that launched 1,000 Riot Girl and Homo Core zines that followed. Keep up the good work. Thanks again.
Is that a he or she? Is that a him or a her?
Hi guys, this is Judd from the Bronx, longtime listener and big fan. I just listened to your episode on Riot Girl at 25, and I just wanted to call and say that I was a teenager in the early 90s, and when I was about 12 or 13, I wrote a letter to Kathleen Hanna asking her for advice on how to be a young man and a feminist. And she wrote back, and it was a really great letter that I got from her, and now I'm 35, and I'm a high school teacher in the Bronx who teach a lot of young ladies, and I have a daughter, and I try to keep her advice and keep what Riot Girl and feminism stood for at that time and still stands for today in mind, and kind of pay those lessons forward. Anyway, thanks for the show.
Messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.